Okay, here we go. That makes sense now. Is this the 19th?
Today is the 19th,
yeah. All right. So we're on the 19th of January. We are in our study on the post-exilic history of Israel. What exile are we post of that we're studying here? Well, it's the Babylonian exile is the one that we're studying beyond. But that's the one that is referred to in our little title there. And so we're looking at these years of Israel's history, that where we have any history, that are after that Babylonian exile. That 70-year exile has come and gone, and the Jews have returned, some of them, from the Babylonian area where they were held captive back to Judah. And we're studying kind of what went on there. And we've seen that they got busy trying to rebuild the temple. Then they got real unbusy not rebuilding the temple like they should have been. And God had to send some people to kind of jumpstart them, get them going again. We're talking about this time frame here. They went back in about 536 B.C. under the leadership of Zerubbabel and Joshua, the high priest, started building the temple and then ran out of steam, got intimidated into doing nothing, and did nothing for a while. And God sent some of his prophets here, Haggai and Zechariah, to sort of motivate them and get them jump-started again. And they did. And they finally completed the thing then in 516, which was 20 years after they began it. But that only took about 15 of those 20 years was doing nothing. So it only took about 5 years to build the thing. And so we got down to about 516, the completion of the temple, historically. And then we jumped those rails and went over to the book of Esther, because Esther occurs between chapter 6 and 7 of Ezra, where we were. So we said, well, let's go over and see what's going on there. Let me just show you once again. Here's our path that we're following. We started in Ezra, looked at the first four chapters, and then he referred to the ministry of Haggai and Zechariah. So we went over and looked at that. Came back to Ezra and looked at chapters 5 and 6. And then here between 6 and 7, we're looking at Esther. And we'll come back to Ezra when we finish up our little jaunt over into Esther here. Now in Esther, we've seen some interesting goings on in the Persian Empire. You remember, it began with a job opening that arose in the Persian Empire for queen. The queen of the Persian Empire, named Vashti, disobeyed, disregarded, kind of humiliated her husband when he asked her to come into a banquet and sort of display her beauty to all of his drunken friends. She could have been a pig with lipstick on, and she would look good to them, probably, if they're all drunk. Anyway, she refused, and off with the head. Or at least, she went out of the picture. We don't know for certain what happened to her. Oh, thank you. But we'll assume that she did not fare well. That would probably be a good assumption. And so, that brings onto the stage another one of our major characters, this young lady named Esther. The way they were going to replace Vashti was through a beauty contest, a beauty pageant. So this is something that a beautiful young lady like Esther had a chance at least. And not only did she have a chance, but she actually was selected by the king to be the replacement for Vashti. And so now we have this young lady, Esther, one of our main players, the one for whom the book is named, as queen of the Persian Empire. Extraordinary event. Persian Empire stretched from Ethiopia and Africa all the way around to India. 127 different provinces. And she is queen over all of that. So that put her in a place to influence events and things. And God is going to use her to do things. But another guy comes on the scene. Well, he was on the scene to begin with. A guy named Mordecai was her cousin slash guardian. Esther was an orphan, and so her cousin Mordecai is taking care of her. I assume he was the age of her father or something like that. And so she obeyed him and treated him like he was her father, and he treated her and tried to protect her and take care of her like she was his daughter. So Mordecai is on the scene now, and he actually hears of a plot to kill the king of the Persian Empire and tells Esther about it, and she reports it to the king, and Mordecai becomes a hero, well-respected and liked there in the kingdom. So God has two of his people, these are both Jews, Mordecai and Esther, in positions of influence in the empire. From nowhere. Came out of nowhere. Nobody's from nowhere. And now they are in this position down in the Persian Empire. Then another guy comes on the scene. His name is Haman. He is politically and economically progressing extremely well in the Persian Empire. He's moving up. What's that show? Moving up to the west side or something like that? Yeah, he moved up to the west side real quick, like. But there's a problem with him. His ancestry traces back to Esau. Mordecai and Esther's ancestry traces back to Jacob. Long time ago, long, long time ago. But unfortunately, the tribal hatred that resided in that part of the world between those two descendancies from that time now has kind of ripened Mordecai up to a point where Haman hates Mordecai. Haman being a descendant of Esau and Mordecai being a descendant of Jacob. When Haman, this guy who's progressing well and moving up the ladder quickly in the Persian Empire, learns that Mordecai is around and doing things, he wants to get rid of him. Haman hates Mordecai and Mordecai's people.
Was Haman liked by other people? Or was he a jerk?
We don't know. You would normally think that somebody that is progressing that rapidly would be admired and respected by the authority, the king in this particular case, but he shows such little interest in some things that it's hard to believe that he's doing much of anything. So I don't know the answer to that question.
He's
good. Plus, he knows how to bribe. And he did. He bribed the king and said, if you let me wipe out these nasty old Jews living throughout your empire, I'll give you something like, $360 million, something like that was his offer? Yeah, $360 million. $360 million to the king. Bribed him. And the king shows very little interest in anything other than getting the money. So he says to Haman, go do it. So Haman puts into place a plan that allows everybody in the empire to, on a certain date, go kill all the Jews they can and take all of their stuff. And that's where he's going to get the 360 mil. Apparently, he takes what he can get from the Jews and gives it to the king. So he's bribing his way up the ladder in some cases. And Mordecai learns about this, strangely enough, and he kind of shows some remorse, or not remorse, but shows some chagrin publicly, and Esther gets involved with why he's doing that and so on, and she gets the word of what's about to take place, and so she's going to try to intervene on behalf of her people to the Persian king, even though that's a high-risk move for her, because she is one of the ones that are targeted for execution. She's a Jew. So if she does nothing, she will probably be killed as part of this massacre herself. But she finally decides she is going to take that chance. She's going to approach the king, who is unapproachable without an invitation. She's going to approach him by just making herself seen by him, and hopefully he'll invite her into his presence and she can explain to him this plot that Haman has set in place and see if she can maybe get some help for him. So, the way she goes about this is that she puts together a feast, a banquet, and invites only Haman and the king, of course. She's doing it for him. So she's getting Haman out in his presence so that she can hopefully intervene on behalf of her people. Now, that gets us to chapter 6, where we want to continue on here this morning. Haman has built this gallows 75 feet high at his house. He was going to try to hang Mordecai on it. And everything's kind of set up to stretch Mordecai's neck. But it doesn't work out quite that well. Because in verse 1 of chapter 6, during that night, that is the night between the first banquet that Esther was going to put together and a second one that she had invited him and Mordecai to, the king could not sleep. Oh, what a coincidence. This guy's kind of a little bit spun up. He's a little wired, the king is. So he gave an order to bring the book of records, the chronicles, and they were read before the king. Why would he choose that as a means to try to get to sleep? Probably because it's so flipping boring that it'd knock him to sleep, you know, after the first couple paragraphs. I don't know. At any rate, he gets that history out, the archives of edicts and decrees and things like that in the Persian Empire. And it was found, written, that Mordecai had reported concerning these two guys, Bigthana and Teresh, to the king's eunuchs, who were the doorkeepers, that they had sought to lay hands on the king Ahasuerus. These are the two guys that plotted to kill the king, and Mordecai learned of it and got the word to him via Esther. Kind of saved the king's bacon, and so Mordecai became his new best friend. So the king said, well, what honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? And the king's servants who attend him say, nothing's been done for him. Oh, geez. Mordecai saved a guy's life and he got nothing. So the king said, well, who's in the court? Who we got around here we could ask about this? Now, Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace. What a coincidence. He just happened to be in the building. And in order to speak to the king about hanging Mordecai on the gallows which he had prepared for him. So Haman comes, he shows up in the narrative because he's wanting to talk to the king about hanging Mordecai. The irony of some of this stuff is just unbelievable, isn't it? So here's our boy Haman. He's in the building and the king's servant says, hey, Haman's out there. He's standing in the court. The king said, well, get him in here. So Haman came in and the king said to him, what is to be done for the man whom the king desires to honor? He asks Haman to describe to him what would be an appropriate honor for somebody that the king wants to honor. Haman, of course, is going to think it's him. But he's not. He's asking about Mordecai. He just doesn't know that. So Haman says, who would the king desire to honor more than me? I got to be the guy here he's talking about. So I'll tell him what I would like. So verse 7, Haman says to the king, for the man whom the king desires to honor, let him bring in a royal robe which the king has worn, and the horse on which the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown has been placed. So he says, dress this guy up like the king, let him ride his ride, a horse of some kind, put a crown on his head, let the robe and horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble princes, and let them array the man whom the king desires to honor, and lead him on horseback through the city square, and proclaim before him, thus it shall be done for the man whom the king desires to honor. So, Haman's suggestion is, dress this guy up like royal to himself, take him out and parade him around through the city square, talking to everybody about how great and wonderful he is, and this is the guy that the king wants to honor. Well, that all sounds pretty good, doesn't it? unfortunately. It wasn't Haman that was going to get it. He just described what Mordecai is going to get. So verse 10, the king said to Haman, take quickly the robes and the horse that you have set and do so for Mordecai the Jew. Well, wouldn't you like to have seen that guy's face at that moment?
Yeah,
that would have been something, wouldn't it? He's probably spitting and sputtering. He didn't know what to think or say. And do not fall short of anything of all that you have said to him. Do it exactly like you said, and don't cut any corners. Go honor this guy Mordecai. So then Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman hurried home, mourning with his head covered. I bet it was. Well, he just got... he got the rug pulled out from under him big time, didn't he? You can't make this stuff up. You couldn't sit down and write this as a writer of plots and things like that. And God just pieces it together. Not a problem. So Haman gets home and he recounted to his lovely wife, Zeresh, and all his friends, everything that had happened to him. And his wise men and Zeresh, his wife, said to him, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish origin, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. They understood the principle that God takes care of his people, and his people are Jewish. So his wife and his friends, they know enough to warn the guy, hey, you are about to fall through the ice here. But Mordecai apparently, Haman apparently did not understand that history and the relationship between God and his people nearly as well as his friends and his wife, because their warning is sound. They told him the truth. If he's a Jew, you aren't going to defeat him like you're trying to do. So while they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hastily brought Haman to the banquet which Esther had prepared. Now remember, Esther asked the king, he asked her, what would you like? Anything you want. And she says, well, I want you and Mordecai, you and Haman to come to this banquet I've prepared for you. That's what I want. So the king said, fine, we'll join you at the banquet. So they come and get Haman, some eunuchs, and escort him then back to this banquet that has been prepared for just Haman and the king. So, verse 7. Now the king and Haman came to drink wine with Esther the queen. So they stroll in and they're going to enjoy this banquet together. And the king said to Esther on the second day also, as they drank wine at the banquet, what is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to half the kingdom it shall be done. So he asks her a second time to tell him, the king, what she would like. He knows she's wanting something, so he invites her a second time at the second banquet to state what that is. And Esther says, verse 3 of chapter 7, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me as my petition and my people as my request. So she's asking for herself and her Jewish compadres, her people. That's her one thing that she's asking for. For if we had been sold, I wouldn't be bothering you and my people to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Or we have been sold, and my people to be destroyed, annihilated. If it only been as slaves, if we've only been sold as slaves, I wouldn't have bothered you with this. I would have remained silent, for the trouble would not be commensurate with annoyance to the king. So she's saying, look, if it was just a matter that we'd been sold into captivity by somebody, I wouldn't ask you this. But we're going to be killed. We're going to be annihilated. We're all facing death here. So ask the king Ahasuerus asked Queen Esther, who is he and where is he who would presume to do this? Who would do this to you? The king asks. I'm sure rather indignantly when he learns that his wife and her countrymen are all destined to be killed. And so Esther says, answers the question, verse 6, a foe and an enemy is this wicked Haman. So she points out the only two men at the banquet was the king and Haman. He, the other guy other than you, he's the guy. Yeah, go ahead, Sheila.
This is the first time the king has become aware that she's Jewish, right?
Apparently so. No indication. Now, Haman knew Mordecai was Jewish. Remember when he learned that, that's what got him so mad at him. But I don't know of any record where we see that Esther has been identified thusly. You could probably figure something out if she's his ward, if he's taking care of her like a father. Somebody could probably put two and two together, but I'm not sure.
Esther and Mordecai aren't telling the king that they're related to each other. And matter of fact, Mordecai specifically told her in earlier verses not to say that she's Jewish.
Yeah. You would think somebody who knew the two of them might could put two and two together there, but apparently not. If anybody knows, it's just not being spoken, apparently.
Yeah, this whole thing is not very complimentary of the king.
No. So she dumps on Haman. He's the wicked guy who is threatening to kill me, your wife, and my kinsmen. And then Haman became terrified before the king and queen. I imagine so. What do you think this guy is thinking? He's trying, I'm sure, to spin this thing in a way that gets him not killed. But I don't think there's anything he can do. So the king arose in his anger from drinking wine and went into the palace garden. He's got to step outside for a few minutes and cool off a little bit. So he leaves the room, and it's just Esther and Haman left behind there. But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm had been determined against him by the king. He knew that the king was going to chop this guy's head off, and his only hope was to plead to Esther that she might intervene on his behalf. I would think the chances of that happening would be slim. So, when the king returned from the palace garden to the place where they were drinking wine, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. Now, this situation got real embarrassing real quick. He's falling all over the queen, physically falling on her. And, I mean, to his credit, it doesn't seem to be that he's any doing anything akin to that. He's just so desperate that he's, I'm sure, just trying to get to her, trying to talk to her, whatever, in any way he can. And the king comes in and sees him falling all over her. He says, will he even assault a queen with me in the house? And the word went out of the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. So that was the end of Haman. His life ended right there. He just doesn't know it yet. So the whole scene devolves into one of apparent, not only is Haman identified as the wicked player in all of this, but he looks like he's even assaulting the queen, which is kind of like what goes around comes around, only comes around many times for Haman, right? So he knows he's finished. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs who were before the king, said, behold, indeed, the gallows standing in Haman's house, 50 cubits high, which Haman had made for Mordecai, who spoke good on behalf of the king, and the king said, hang him on it. So this masterful piece of hanging equipment that Haman has built, he was going to use it on Mordecai, now they're going to use it on him. So they hanged Haman on the gallows which he had prepared for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided. Who could have imagined this series of events ahead of time? Haman was moving and grooving. He had the king's confidence. He bribed him to be able to go out and kill all the Jews, and the king agreed, gave him his magic decoder ring to stamped the edict, and everything was going Haman's way. And all of a sudden, it all got reversed. Esther steps into the scene, explains what's going on, identifies to the king that Haman is the enemy of her and her people and wanted to kill them. The king had already offered her anything she wanted, and she wanted their safety and him taking care of them. And so the king did, and Haman ends up hanging on the 75 feet high gallows.
So when the king told Haman he could go do this and go kill the Jews and get $380 million in debt, and then when Esther started talking, he wasn't putting two and two together yet. But he was like, "Who is this man?" He had already told, given him permission to.
Well, he apparently didn't know that she was part of the group that was going to get killed.
Right.
He was just asking for somebody in his kingdom. And strangely enough, his care about that seemed to be non-existent. He didn't seem to care at all who it was. That's really, really, really terrible leadership on his part. Not to even ask, well, who are these people in my kingdom that you say should be killed? And he never even asked.
What I was thinking is that the king didn't know it was all the Jews, correct?
Apparently not.
He just knew that there was this evil out there.
That's right.
Haman brought it to him and didn't name him.
Until Esther told him that it was her, and her people that she was intervening on behalf of. So it's extremely poor government, to say the least, in addition to all the other evils associated with the plot and so on. So we've got to say at this point in time, I think, that Haman's plan didn't work out too well. He was a victim of his own plan. And his great enemy, who he couldn't stand, was reaping the benefits and blessings of his prosperity in the honoring being given to Mordecai. So, as fast as it appears that Haman was ascending in the geopolitical, eco-political situation in Persia, looks like Mordecai just blew past him. And he's the one actually blessed. So, that all has changed. That sounds good. But we got this little problem remaining of the edict that the Persian king had signed that allowed them to have this massacre day against the Jews. We got to get that undone, remember? That's everybody's out there just waiting for the day to come around when they can kill the Jews and take their stuff. So on that day, King Ahasuerus gave the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, to Queen Esther. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had disclosed that what he was to her. There's their statement of the fact that she's a Jew to him and so on. So he knows for sure now. But she's got all Haman's stuff, got his household and all that stuff. And the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken away from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. So Mordecai now has all of Haman's stuff, his household and everything. And again, we've got to keep reminding ourselves what's driving this plot and causing it to turn like it is Haman's hatred. The guy had it made. He was doing well in life. All he had to do was just kind of grin and bear the fact that Mordecai was doing okay, or whatever the case may be. But he hated him so much, he just had to have him killed. And it blew up in his own face. So Mordecai is now over Haman's house. Esther spoke again to the king, fell at his feet, wept, and implored him to avert the evil scheme of Haman the Agagite and his plot which he had devised against the Jews. So Esther is intervening here now on behalf of the Jews. And the king extended the golden scepter to Esther. So Esther arose and stood before the king. If he didn't stick that scepter out there, she couldn't stay. She couldn't come into his presence. So by sticking that scepter in front of her, she can touch that and she can get up and come in and talk to him. So
see, that actually reminds me of, you know, that urge to kill him, reminded David, you know, his enemy, you know, kept, wasn't he that, you know, the guy kept back him and after him, and he wouldn't, you know, he wouldn't let up.
You mean Saul, when Saul was chasing him?
Yeah,
when Saul was chasing David, yeah. Yeah, David wouldn't harm.
No, not that he would, but, you know, I was thinking about that. Anyway, it's okay. I just thinking about the similarity of the hatred.
Yeah.
Pursued.
Yeah. Boy, there's one major lesson just really stands out of this book, and that is, you know, hatred can just override everything else in your thinking and cause you to do and to think things that are absolutely incorrect and so on. And Haman is a classic example of that. Hatred cost him everything he had in life. Anyway, so the king extends the invitation to Esther to say what she wants. So she says in verse 5, "If it please the king, and if I have found favor before him, and the matter seems proper to the king, and I am pleasing in his sight, let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, which he wrote to destroy the Jews which are in all the king's provinces. So undo what Haman did, please. For how can I endure to see the calamity which shall befall my people, and how can I endure to see the destruction of my kindred?" So she couldn't live having to observe the actual execution of Haman's plan. So the king says to Esther and to Mordecai, "Behold, I've given the house of Haman to Esther, and him they have hanged on the gallows because he has stretched out his hand against the Jews. Now you write to the Jews as you see fit." Here's a blank check, guys. Fill in the amount. "In the king's name, and seal it with the king's signet ring," which he had given to Mordecai. "Seal it with the king's signet ring, for a decree which is written in the name of the king and sealed with the king's signet ring may not be revoked." So see, that's the problem of the first one, is that Haman already got that first decree to kill all the Jews. He got that one sealed and got the royal rotary stamp on it. So they couldn't just undo it, but they're giving them a chance now to kind of write whatever they need to kind of combat the circumstances here, and they too then can sign it with the signet ring. So the king's scribes were called in at that time in the third month, that is the month of Sivan, on the 23rd day. Remember, that massacre was going to take place on the 12th month, so there's 9 months between this time frame and when the massacre of the Jews was supposed to take place. "And it was written according to all that Mordecai commanded to the Jews, the satraps, the governors, the princes, the provinces, which extend from India to Ethiopia, 127 of them, to every province according to its script, and every people according to their language, as well as the Jews according to their script and their language." So these guys can write now whatever they want to, and it will be put in the language of all of the people. Everybody will see what this is saying. "So he wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed it with the king's signet ring and sent letters by couriers on horses riding on steeds sired by the royal stud." And they got the best rides they got involved here now. Got the royal stud involved here even. "And in these letters, the king granted the Jews who were in each and every city the right to assemble and to defend their lives." So, all of a sudden now, the Jews can fight back. They can plan. They can organize. We've got 9 months before this is going to take place. So they can get ready for it. "To prevent being destroyed, to kill, annihilate the entire army of any people or province which might attack them." So they can defeat any organized attack against them with whatever they can. They can protect themselves, including children and women, and to plunder their spoils. So whoever attacks them in the provinces on that day, the Jews can, if they can beat them back, they can take their stuff. So what Haman thought he was going to do in taking the Jews' stuff, now they're going to take whoever attacks them's stuff. And one day in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, the 13th day of the month, that is the month Adar. So this event was going to happen over one day. A copy of the edict was to be issued as law in each and every province and published to all the peoples, so that the Jews should be ready for this day to avenge themselves on their enemies. You know, when you watch these movies of Second World War and the massacre of the Jews, the Holocaust and all that stuff, the passivity of the Jews is kind of remarkable, isn't it? They don't seem to ever fight back. They just walk into those chambers and get smoked. Here, they have 9 months to prepare for it. There, I realize it's a different set of circumstances, but still, it's just always struck me as, guys, try something, anything. You're going to be a bar of soap soon. Fight. Try something. And they don't. Or they didn't. What's that?
Do you think it was mostly fear?
Well, mostly, I suppose. But it's striking the passivity of the people under the Nazis and people like that. So they got this new set of publications now to be distributed throughout the empire, which in effect gives the Jews a chance to fight back. And so the couriers hastened, and impelled by the king, command went out, riding on the royal steeds, and a decree was given out in Susa, the capital. So they're getting the word out now, 9 months in advance of the date that the Jews can protect themselves. So Mordecai went out, verse 15, from the presence of the king in royal robes of blue and white, with a large crown of gold and a garment of fine linen and purple, and the city of Susa shouted and rejoiced. Now there doesn't seem to be an extraordinary high degree of anti-Semitism in place. We know we've got some particular examples here, and we're seeing it worked out. But, I mean, the people are welcoming Mordecai pretty much with open arms here, it seems. So that doesn't seem to be too much of a problem. For the Jews, there was light and gladness and joy and honor. And in each and every province, in each and every city, wherever the king's commandment and his decree arrived, there was gladness and joy for the Jews, a feast and a holiday. Seemed to be like they were well accepted by the other people, doesn't it? Many among the peoples of the land became Jews, for the dread of the Jews had fallen on them. All of a sudden now, the people are fearing that, whoa, wait a minute now, the Jews can fight back. And they're better than we are. They're good at this. And so the dread of them starts to settle in amongst the general population there. So the circumstances have been potentially reversed. We don't know how it's all going to come out, but at least now the Jews can fight back. So going on, chapter 9, in the 12th month, that is the month Adar, in the 13th day, this was the date on which the massacre was to take place, the day when the king's command and edict were about to be executed, on the day when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain the mastery over them, it was turned to the contrary, so that the Jews themselves gained the mastery over those who hated them. So Haman's plan was just flip-flopped. Instead of the people taking all of the Jews' stuff and killing them off, the Jews killed off their enemies, anyone who would try to harm them, and took their stuff. Turned that plan inside out, didn't he? The Jews assembled in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought to harm them, and no one could stand before them, for the dread of them had fallen on all the people. The fear of God has been in sorts instilled in the people as the fear of the Jews. Even all the princes of the provinces, the satraps, the governors, and those who were doing the king's business assisted the Jews because the dread of Mordecai had fallen on them. So they actually get some help from the Persian public. Indeed, Mordecai was great in the king's house, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces, for the man Mordecai became greater and greater. The very thing that Haman was trying to acquire for himself, admiration and so on from the people, Mordecai ended up getting. All right. Verse 5, thus the Jews struck all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying, and they did what they pleased to those who hated them. And in Susa, the capital, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. So in the capital city, there was an accounting of at least 500 Persians who tried to destroy the Jews, and they were destroyed. And Haman's 10 sons are listed there in verses 7 through 9. They were all hanged as well. But the Jews, verse 10, did not lay their hands on the plunder. They didn't take all of the Persians' plunder, but they did defend themselves and were very successful at that. So on the day that the number of those who were killed in Susa, the capital, was reported to the king, king said to Queen Esther, the Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men and 10 sons of Haman. What then have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? If this is just a local number, 510, I wonder what they did throughout the whole empire. So now what is your petition? It shall even be granted you. What is your further request? It shall also be done. So what else can I do for you, Esther? And she said, well, if it pleases the king, let tomorrow be granted to the Jews who are in Susa to do according to the edict of today. Extend this day, this massacre day, one more day, is Esther's request. And let Haman's 10 sons be hanged on the gallows. Boy, what else can you do for us, Dad? So the king commanded that it should be done so, and an edict was issued in Susa, and Haman's 10 sons were hanged. And the Jews who were in Susa assembled also on the 14th day of the month of Adar and killed 300 men in Susa, and they did not lay their hands on the plunder. So they added another 300 deaths in the capital city alone, besides the 500 previous day, by extending that additional day. And the rest of the Jews who were in the king's provinces assembled to defend their lives and rid themselves of their enemies and kill 75,000 of those who hated them, but they didn't lay their hands on the plunder. So throughout the empire, the Jews killed 75,000 Persians who were attacking the Jews, taking advantage of the opportunity to kill the Jews free day, and they paid the price to the tune of 75,000 people. Clearly, there was some anti-Semitism in the kingdom. There were enough people that hated the Jews that wanted to try to kill them off, given an opportunity, that 75,000 of them bit the dust. And this was done on the 13th day of the month of Adar and the 14th day, and they rested and made it a day of feasting and rejoicing. So 2 days, the 13th and 14th of their, I think it's actually their third month of the year, 12th month in the cycle that they were going through back then, they actually made a feast out of this event. But the Jews who were in Susa assembled on the 13th and 14th of the same month, and they rested on the 15th day and made it a day of feasting and rejoicing. So a two-day feast was originated here to celebrate this happening, the 13th and the 14th of this month of Adar. Therefore, the Jews of the rural areas who live in the rural towns make the 14th day of the month of Adar a holiday for rejoicing and feasting and sending portions of food to one another. So a new holiday has been originated as a result of this massacre attempt on the 13th and 14th of Adar. The rural areas apparently just celebrated it on the one day. Susa, the capital, looks like they did it on 2 days. And they celebrated by giving food to one another and kind of like a little, I don't know, mini Thanksgiving of some kind. So then Mordecai recorded these events, and he sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, obliging them to celebrate the 14th day of the month, Adar, and the 15th day of the same month annually. So Mordecai started this feast. It would be the Feast of Purim. Pure is a dice. Pure M is two dices, two lots. So Haman was using lots, casting lots, casting dice to see when he should do all of this stuff, and that's where this feast gets its name. Because in those days the Jews rid themselves of their enemies, and it was a month in which was turned for them from sorrow into gladness and from mourning into a holiday, that this should make them days of feasting and rejoicing and sending portions of food to one another and gifts to the poor. I think even today the Jews make cookies. They call them Haman cookies, something like that. Thus the Jews undertook what they had started to do and what Mordecai had written to them. For Haman, the son of this guy, the Agagite, the adversary of all the Jews, had schemed against the Jews to destroy them and had cast Pur, that is the lot, to disturb them and to destroy them. But it came about to the king's attention. He commanded by letter that that wicked scheme which had been devised against the Jews should return on his own head, and that he and his sons should be hanged on the gallows. Therefore they called these days Purim, I-M means more than one, after the name of Pur. So that's how the name got started. And because of the instructions in this letter, both what they had seen in this regard and what they had happened to them, the Jews established and made a custom for themselves. Now, God did not institute this feast as part of the original group there in the book of Leviticus. This is one that the Jews added. Hanukkah was the same way. When they threw off Antiochus Epiphanes, they came up with one on their own, and they came up with one on their own here. So they have some feasts that God initiated in the book of Leviticus, and then they have a few that they initiated as a nation themselves. Jews established and made a custom for themselves and for their descendants and for all those who allied themselves with them so that they should not fail to celebrate these 2 days according to their regulation, according to their appointed annual time. So they kind of formalized the feast and get everybody to celebrate it each year. So these days were to be remembered and celebrated throughout every generation, every family, every province, and every city. These days of Purim were not to fail from among the Jews or their memory fade from their descendants. So this is a established reminder of what happened to the Jews and for the Jews on this day called the Feast of Purim. So then Queen Esther, daughter of Abihail, with Mordecai the Jew, wrote and with full authority to confirm the second letter about Purim. So sent letters to all the Jews and to the 127 provinces, the king of Ahasuerus, namely words of peace and truth, to establish these days of Purim in their appointed times, just as Mordecai the Jew and Queen Esther established for them, and just as they had established for themselves and for their descendants, and then instructions for their times of fasting and lamentations. And the command of Esther established these customs for Purim, and it was written in the book. Not sure what book they're talking about there, but I think it's an important book, because they wrote this stuff down in it. So the king laid a tribute to the land and to the coastlands of the sea and all the accomplishments of his authority and strength and full account of the greatness of Mordecai, to which the king advanced him. Are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Media and Persia? Mordecai the Jew was second only to King Ahasuerus and great among the Jews and in favor with the multitude of his kinsmen, one who sought the good of his people and one who spoke for the welfare of his whole nation. And as you see, as we end chapter 10, we still haven't seen God's name. It is not in the book. But God's hand is in the book. We've seen many, many things. I was compiling a little list of what looked to me like divine providential decisions and so on as we went through. I've got a list of about 20 of them here. We'll review them next time. We don't have to go over them here this morning. But there's a number of things in this little summary that just kind of bespeak to us of God's providential care. These guys, there's no Daniel wannabes in this group. These are not spiritual giants within the ones that are still back in Babylon. Even Esther needed a little prodding by Mordecai to consider the fact that maybe God was at work here doing something through her. because of her unusual circumstances, but she never seems to actually acknowledge believing God is working through her. So the people's spiritual cognizance and insight to what's going on appears to be kind of thin, to say the least, unlike Daniel and his friends down there in Babylon before, a few years before. But
well, don't you think that's because they're opposite ends of the spectrum?
I'm sorry?
Opposite ends of the spectrum.
Yeah.
Daniel's closer to the first,
mm-hmm.
the beginning of the 70 years. This is after.
Yeah.
And some, but to me, one of the things that it tells us is a lot of Jews stay, they did not go back to Israel when they could have.
Yeah.
And there was a lot more that were still living in Babylon and in the Persian kingdom.
Yeah.
They were living not only in the capital, a lot of them, without giving any specific numbers, but they were living in all the provinces.
Yeah. Yeah, there was motivation on the part of some. The leadership under Zerubbabel and the high priest, that was kind of admirable. But these other guys didn't seem to be all that much interest in getting back to the homeland, does it?
Well, I think they're doing too well.
Yeah.
I mean,
fat, dumb, and happy, why go back?
And also, that's the whole thing, that this is just a repeat of everything about the Jews going forward. The Jews seem to do well in business and, you know, do well. The locals get jealous of their prosperity and then try to turn on them. And that, you just rinse and repeat that over and over throughout history.
And the lack of mentioning God even by name throughout this whole story, it's kind of an implied indicator of the spiritual state of the people. Doesn't appear to be all that high still back in Babylon, does it? You'd think somebody, a high priest, somebody might be leading a little bit in the spiritual lessons being taught here, calling the prayer meeting and things of that sort.
Well, but those had already gone back.
Apparently the ones that cared did, and the ones that didn't just stayed back. But God took care of them too. He didn't leave them at the disposal of Mordecai and the enemies of the Jews. I will bless them that bless you, and I will curse them that curse you. Transcends years and spiritual condition on the part of the people. That's a promise of God that he maintains and executes on behalf of his folks. We'll go back over some of these events next time, just to kind of review this a little bit before we leave this particular book. But it is a remarkable series of events and thinking that illustrates God's providential care of his people, regardless of their spiritual condition, about as clearly as anything we're going to find. But any questions or comments about what we've seen in this storyline?
Back in the 60s, you remember Speck, and he killed those nine, you know, nurses?
Yeah.
And what brought to mind and what stuck with me over the years is that there were nine of them, you know, and he would take them individually, you know, into the and slaughter them and so on. Anyway, the nurses that remained out in the room, there was one that slept under the bed, you know, and she was safe. But the thing that struck me was that the fear they had was so great that they could not talk to the other nurses, even though they outnumbered him, you know, to do anything, to move.
Yeah.
Toward, you know, doing something to him, so, you know, they could have stopped him.
Yeah, they should have pounced on him with a couple cast iron skillets and beat that guy's head in the floor. And it did nothing.
That was, you know, maybe some of the detail.
Yeah.
Is this modern 60s you're talking about?
Richard Speck. That mass murder up in Chicago.
Chicago.
You may not remember him.
I remember it very well because I was going to go up there after all this.
Yeah, that name doesn't ring any bells to you?
Well, I was a baby. I was a little person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was quite the baby.
He killed nine nurses up in Chicago. This mass murderer, Richard Speck, was the name. One at a time. And what Pam is saying is that, you know, surely that all of them could have jumped on him and beat him down.
Well, they tried to talk him into it, and they refused, you know, to do it. They were too afraid.
Yeah. I guess fear is pretty paralyzing for a lot of people, and that's probably a lot of the explanation for the Jews' inactivity, is afraid.
I mean, in the case of Germany, it does not appear anything I've ever read that the Jews were armed or had any kind of communication. Mm-hmm. The Germans organized and had the weaponry. I mean, they just overwhelmed everybody. There was no preparation. So it's difficult.
Yeah.
And it's not that the Jews didn't respond to most people, they rather well.
Mm-hmm. Didn't respond to what?
They did respond.
Did respond rather
recently.
Well in recent times.
Oh, yeah. Oh, they're the best army on the planet right now. Yeah. Yeah, they are much better prepared, of course, today than back here and some of the stuff we're seeing back there. But I'm sure fear is a very, very big part of their inaction.
I'd very much like to hear what Netanyahu's perspective is on now versus what we're reading.
Whose?
Netanyahu.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Because it would appear to me that he learned something from those stories to say we shall not stand idle. But
he had a brother killed in the battle for Israel's statehood, I believe. I believe Netanyahu did. Yeah. Now, I tell you what, you want to find a warrior, go read about David's life. Nobody could get in that guy's way. He was as good a soldier as you'll find anywhere David was. So they know how to battle for themselves, given the opportunity. And in this particular case, it looks like they took advantage of it. It's almost humorous the way this thing gets flipped. I mean, the stuff that the bad guys were trying so desperately to get falls in the lap of the good guys because of God's providential care.
What a changing perspective that America began 6 months ago.
Oh, yeah. It flipped my opinion when the rapture was going to occur. It backed me up a little bit. I was ready to go.
What's amazing to me is that Mordecai and Haman were kind of related. One was a descendant of Esau, and one was a descendant of Jacob, and those were brothers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that descendancy, unfortunately, did generate into a lot of hatred.
Yeah.
The descendants of Esau never were ever the friends of the Jews. I mean, within, I guess, a generation or two, they were kind of at each other's throats.
But they had a Jewish line in them.
Yeah.
I mean, I just read that. I didn't know the word Jew came from the southern Judah. Southern name of Judah. That's where the Jews really came from. I didn't know. And they became Jews, and the story you just told, they became Jews, which suggests it's not genealogy, it's a choice.
Well, the descendants of Abraham, down through the Jacob side, they had a guy whose name closely resembled Hebrews, and that's where they got their distinguishing name, at least. And then you got a bunch more people. I mean, Abraham had a bunch of sons from Keturah, not from Sarah, and there's a bunch more guys over there that ain't got nothing to do with either one of them, as far as the Abrahamic covenant is concerned.
Well, and also that Abraham's nephew, Lot, some of his grandsons,
mm-hmm.
all through incest, they became like the Moabites
mm-hmm.
and other people that lived on the eastern side of the Dead Sea, and they always had a lot of enmity with the Jews. As a matter of fact, these Amalekites, I mean, the division between started back in the book of Exodus.
Well, Herod was an Edomite.
And the Amittites, who should have were kind of close relatives, fought against them and didn't want them to go through. And so then that's what was the basis of this whole thing.